On this episode of Still Loading, we stare into a golden abyss. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, podcasting friends unite. We meet in person for the first time at last. Today on the show, I have my good friend from the Gaming and Collecting Podcast, from the 3DO Experience, Billiam Barber himself, the Barber Who Games over on Instagram. Bill, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for setting aside some time. We are meeting here live in person. That is right, listeners. This is the first time I think any of my podcasting friends that I've met online, I've recorded in person. So we are recording in person in my hotel room at Retro World Expo, the day before actually Retro World Expo, just to give it a time and place and whatnot. But so to steal something from your own show, how you doing?
Oh, it's weird being on the other side of the foot on that one. See, it's fun because I usually confuse my guests and then they just kind of are like, what? But anyway, I'm doing good. Me and Josh just went out to fancy some of the local cuisine, which is hilarious because I live 20 minutes away from here, but I have know nothing about the city.
Yeah, but the local cuisine, we went to an average pizza joint and I had wings and you had a buffalo chicken salad and yep. It was fine. We won't blast the place, you know, that it's whatever. But we're here to talk today about Uncharted Golden Abyss. And when I first reached out to you, I'm like, hey, I'm coming up to Retro World. We should record in person if you're down for it. What would you want to talk about? And I was saying I wanted to lean towards the Vita because I know you like me are a Vita apologist who are constantly seeing the praises of it. And so I was trying to pick a game. I was thinking either Gravity Rush or Tearaway or Golden Abyss. And you said that you had more more experience with this game. So I guess to lead into that, what are your experiences with Uncharted Golden Abyss?
Well, my experiences with Uncharted Golden Abyss are basically, when the Vita came out, the game selection at launch was not the most amazing. Like, there was a few games, but the only one that really mattered at the time was Uncharted Golden Abyss. Mm-hmm. And that, being an Uncharted fan, like, at this point, so when this game came out, I had already finished Uncharted 1, Uncharted 2, and I had just finished Uncharted 3. 4 was not I don't even think 4 was announced yet. And so when I saw Uncharted on the go, I was like, okay, I want to see what this is. And then I saw the first like trailer shot, and I'm like, that looks almost as good as Uncharted 1.
Seriously, it looks like a PS3 game.
It was amazing. Like, that was like the first point where I really was like, okay, the Vita is actually something serious to like consider here.
Exactly.
And then Sony proceeded to do nothing with it for 5-6 years.
The thing that kills me about the Vita, dude, is that like there was so much potential with it. I'm not talking about the touch controls either, though I do think in the right hands, specifically Tearaway, the touch controls are can be used really well. Tearaway, that's the only game I think I've ever seen where they take the quote unquote gimmick of the console and actually make it fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's really good. Yeah, I'm with you because I think the thing that kills me about the Vita, like I said, it had a lot of potential. But like Uncharted Golden Abyss, Tearaway, Gravity Rush, and even eventually like Danganronpa and stuff like that, like they had these really good games that were exclusive to Vita. Because I feel like the downfall of the PSP, what ultimately, even though it sold really well, but ultimately why it lost to the DS is that they were trying to port games from home consoles over to the system instead of creating original experiences for it that could only be played on the system. And whether, you know, the DS, I think because of the motion control thing, it kind of worked out well with that. And so I feel like Sony kind of tried, like, okay, well, Nintendo ate our lunch a little bit with it because they had this unique control scheme. Let's do that for our Vita. This is me speculating, by the way, listeners. I don't have like an in to Sony with this, but So they did all the, you know, the front touchscreen, the back touchscreen, the gyro, all these other cool things. And some games utilized it and others did not. Also, Killzone was really good on the Vita as well.
It was. Killzone was really good. Resistance had a really solid...
Burning Skies, I want to say. Yeah.
The multiplayer was terrible, but this campaign was phenomenal.
Really? I own that too. I haven't really played it. I actually brought with me Burning Skies to play on... Not Burning Skies, I'm sorry. The Killzone with me. I'm like,
Killzone Mercenary, I think it was?
Yes, Mercenary. Yeah, okay. So did I'm sorry if I cut you off. Do you have anything more for your own final experiences on Uncharted Golden Abyss?
Not so much. I was very fascinated when I saw it was being made by Ben Studio, which is one of the most underrated studios Sony has.
Dude, underrated and also have done some weird stuff. They did Siphon Filter.
Bubsy 3D was their first game.
I was telling you off mic. I was like, dude, there's one thing I want you to react to, and it was that. I wasn't sure. I assumed you had known that one already specifically. Yeah,
that's one of my favorite jokes. Where it was like when Days Gone came out, I was like, remember, guys, this studio also made this
Bubsy 3D,
and I'm like, look at how far they've came. Well, it's funny too because if you play Siphon Filter, like that runs off the Bubsy 3D engine.
Does it really?
It's like the same tank controls and stuff. And
God.
If you look at it really closely, it's very obviously an improved version of that engine they made.
I did not know that. That's really funny. I played Siphon Filter as well. I remember my one of my childhood friends had it, and I would play it at his house. And it was one of the first games I ever played that it was like involved shooting guns and violence. I was like, this is fucking metal.
I think the reason a lot of people didn't notice it is because the game Siphon Filter is a stealth like action game, and it clearly works better on that control setup than a platformer does, which I think is the reason why. I mean, Siphon Filter's aged quite a bit. I love it to death because it has the greatest taser in all of gaming.
What? Okay.
Have you?
I don't remember a thing about the game.
So Siphon Filter, one of your main weapons is the taser. You can literally tase people across the screen and just like tase people to death.
That's kind of fantastic.
Like, you literally tase them until they set on fire, and it's like, Jesus, this thing kills everybody.
I had no idea. But yeah, that's wild. So Ben Studios, yes, made Bubsy 3D, Siphon Filter. They also did the Resistance game for the PSP, which apparently is Resistance Retribution, which is not bad, actually.
It runs off the same engine that the last two Siphon Filters on PSP ran off of.
Oh, okay. I actually I don't think I own any of the Siphon Filters for PSP. I should do that, because that's kind of like where the series ended up at. Like, there wasn't really any home console stuff after the PS1. So there
was Dark Mirror, which was actually interesting because both those games were later ported to PS2 because a lot of PSP games were reverse ported.
Yeah.
Which was really weird. But Dark Mirror was actually really dark, like as the title would suggest. Like, it was M-rated and like probably the darkest in the series. When it got ported to PS2, they edited it and actually it downgraded it to rated T because it was too dark.
I'm going to have to, maybe at Retro World, I'm going to seek out. That's one of the parts of my collection I always want to get more of is the PSP, because it's an area of gaming that I don't really touch that much. And I do patron polls for my show. Maybe this is a little hint, but you know, last one I focused on the Wii, because the Wii is another system I don't really play all that much. So Epic Mickey won that one. I was thinking of doing PSP this time around for this next quarterly poll. So we'll see about that. From my own experience, to bring it back to Uncharted Golden Abyss, my own experience was, likewise, I saw that it was coming out for the Vita. I saw Uncharted was coming to a handheld. I'm like, I gotta get this. I love Uncharted. And I was blown away. Same thing. The graphics just, I couldn't believe what I was seeing on the Vita. It was such an impressive showcase. And then this game and Gravity Rush will always have a place in my heart, because up until this point, I owned handheld systems. I had a Game Boy, I had a GBA, I had a DS even, I had a PSP. I had not beaten a single game on any of them. I always played console games. I never touched the handheld. The Vita was the first handheld where the games I liked the games enough in order to actually set aside time and like really focus and play through them. So I played through Golden Abyss. I played through Tearaway. I played through a ton of games on my Vita. And I never really got involved in the ecosystem too much, you know, with like the Nier and everything like that, which does tie into Golden Abyss a little bit. We'll touch on that. But yeah, it's not like the Switch where I feel like I'm part of the ecosystem versus, but the Vita, I guess it didn't really have much of one in the first place.
The Nier thing was like, I would always boot it up and it'd be like no one was nearby and I'd be like, well, this is boring.
That's the issue where it's like it was their version of Street Pass, but because no one bought the Vita comparatively to the 3DS, there was just never anyone around. Like I would bring my 3DS to work. I mean the Vita, you would like, because the 3DS you get like notifications like with a little light of when someone's nearby. The Vita, you didn't have anything like that.
Yeah,
but one of my favorite things to do when I was driving, I have like a 40-minute commute, I would leave my 3DS on in the car in sleep mode and I would see if I would get any street passes on the way to work, and periodically I would. I'm like, yes, someone on like traveling on a bus nearby or something like that. But anyway, yeah, so with the Vita, I will always hold this game it's very special to me because of that, because it was, I was kind of like a late bloomer in terms of getting into handheld gaming. This game was one of the first games I played that really I was able to sink my teeth into. Some fun facts about it. It actually came out in Japan first. It came out on December 17th, 2011 in Japan, and came out on February 15th, 2012 in North America. What's wild about this game is that its origins and development actually date back to 2008, because one of the things I was reading, there's an amazing, you have to find it on the Internet Archive. It's from an old 1UP article. There was the making of Uncharted Golden Abyss by Matt Leone. And Matt Leone, he did an oral history of like Street Fighter and a Final Fantasy VII. So like this dude, he's legit. Like he's a really great journalist and author and writer and all that other stuff. So I found his article from like 2012, shortly after the game came out, I guess, like later on in the year. This game was in development while the Vita was in development. So they were used as kind of the guinea pig for the system. They kind of ended up help shaping some of the, maybe not some of the tech specs, but in terms of like how to develop for like some of the, maybe the interior, like architecture type of thing. Sony had a meeting in 2008 trying to like plan their next handheld system. And that was when their head of worldwide studios, Shuhei Yoshida, he was basically the middleman or the liaison between devs and Sony upper management, because Sony upper management wanted the devs to have a much more hands-on approach to helping them shape this new handheld console, which at the time was unheard of. Like devs very rarely had a say in how a console worked. I mean, you can see that with how the PS3 was made. Like that thing was like a nightmare to program for, from my understanding. So Bend was one of Sony's like kind of big names at the time. They were just coming off of a bunch of hits off the PSP, between the Siphon Filter games, between Resistance Retribution and all that other stuff. So they kind of figured that Sony would want them to kind of make a launch title for it. So they decided to get in on the ground floor, and they specifically chose Uncharted. It wasn't Sony telling them, hey, you make us an Uncharted handheld game. Bend pretty much had run of the mill. They could do whatever they want. So they chose Uncharted because they liked what Naughty Dog had done. And some of the challenges of it were that, you know, when you're working with someone else's IP that's still active, it's not like you're the next branch in the story or something like that. You have to be careful because you don't want to start doing something that's going to contradict what they plan on doing in the future with their IP. So John Garvin, actually the head of the studio, who was also the lead writer and one of the lead designers for the game, worked very closely with Amy Hennig, who obviously, as we know, wrote the Uncharted games, wrote the first three. It was like the lead director and designer.
She wrote the first three, and I think she was partially involved at the start of four before she left the company and the Last of Us team took over.
Yes. And you can definitely tell, it's a story for a different day, but you can tell the tone difference between the two. I'm not saying one's better than the other. I love Uncharted 4. I think you and I are both huge fans of the fourth.
Four is my favorite in the series.
It's a really good one. But anyway, so yeah, he worked very closely with Amy Hennig, and a lot of his ideas initially would get turned down. In fact, there was he initially pitched to Naughty Dog a story of like a Nathan Drake origin story, but that got turned down. A lot of his ideas got turned down until basically he kind of asked like, well, what makes an Uncharted story an Uncharted story? And the thing is, it has to be grounded to history. Mm. You have to start with the history part first and then build the narrative around it, because that's what causes the globe-trotting adventure. You have to have historical fiction at its core. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. The working title for the game when they were working on it was Uncharted Dark Secrets. Kind of a, I don't know. What are you thought? I don't like that. No, it's a little too cheesy.
Golden Abyss is a much, especially once later on with the story, it makes sense. But like Golden Abyss just has a catch. I like that it's not a numbered name. It's mm-hmm. kind of like a, they just kind of, it's got a subtitle that like really, it rolls off the tongue very nicely, but it's also not like super in your face.
Exactly. I'm with you. And it makes more sense, like you said, for the main plot of it ends up being. What's interesting too, when they chose Uncharted, like I said at the beginning, that was before Uncharted 2 even came out. Mm. It was in between 1 and 2 that Bend made the decision, be like, we want to do an Uncharted game on this thing. And I think one of the wildest things I learned about the development from this game, dude, is that they were getting new versions of the development kits every 3 months.
Oh, that must have been a nightmare.
Right? Like, and one of the earliest things, because a lot of the specs weren't locked in, they were using a PSP screen that was connected to like a 6-axis controller, pretty much. And on top of that, the artists really hated it because a PSP screen is very different from the final OLED screen that we got on the Vita. It's larger, and obviously OLED is a lot nicer quality than what was on the PSP. So the artists were having to design assets for what they were assuming the OLED was going to be, but didn't have yet, and they could only see on the PSP screen. Like, this thing was a nightmare for development because it was developed in tandem with the system. So mm-hmm. every time they would update some aspect of it, it would either break parts of the game, and then they would have to figure it out. And then they would have to relay information back to Sony, be like, hey, this isn't working for this, and this reason. So it... I feel like this game had a bigger hand than we would expect in shaping what the Vita's hardware and architecture ended up being.
It actually kind of makes sense that they went with Uncharted 2, because actually it's interesting because this was before Uncharted 2 came out. And
they went with Uncharted as well, I guess.
Yeah. I was gonna
T-O-O.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, it's interesting that they went with Uncharted because that was before Uncharted really became like the – I mean, Uncharted 1, for all intents and purposes, is a very good game, but it's very flawed.
Yes.
In a lot of ways. So this was before the series really became like the smash, like massive success that Uncharted 2, like, still considered one of the greatest games of all time.
Exactly. And that's why it was such an interesting choice. I guess they just saw how good it was. They really liked it. That was the main thing. They didn't pick it because they knew it was going to be a hit. I bet you in the back of their minds, they're like, this game's going to be a hit eventually with some tweaking. And in all honesty, you can see a lot of the influence from Uncharted 1 because the controls are a little janky in this game. There was a lot of times where I would try to grab on a ledge by hitting circle, and Drake would just roll right off the cliff. It was not fun.
Yeah, there's a particular section towards the end of the game where that was very noticeable.
Yeah. Really obnoxious, and the checkpointing was overall pretty fair, but we'll get into the game in a moment. I'm trying to just make sure I've covered the rest of the behind the scenes stuff in my notes. Some of the earliest designs, and I have one last couple other things to bring up, and before we can get into the game in earnest, they received a lot of assets from Naughty Dog. Which makes sense.
I believe they got access to their in full mocap studio.
Yes. And I was watching some of the video of the motion mocap with Richard McGonagall and Nolan North, which was kind of cool to see. It was really cool to see.
Then they brought all the characters that reappear. They got all their original VAs. Cause a lot of the times in these spinoff games, they won't get the full like cast of voice actors. But for this one, a game like Uncharted, they got like all the talent.
I mean, it shows. I Nolan North and Richard McGonagall have some of the best chemistry, period. Like, Sully and Drake is one of the best, like, duos, bromances, whatever you want to call it.
That was actually, so she's not in this game, but just to talk about Elena, like, one of the reasons Elena's voice actress was chosen is because she had such great chemistry with Nolan North.
Mm-hmm.
And they went with her. I think she was actually going with a friend who was going for the role.
Oh, really?
And her... her performance, she just had such a great like chemistry with Nolan North that they ended up casting her as Elena.
I did not actually know that. I didn't know that she went with a friend for that role.
Yeah, she was just going like with someone just to support a friend. I'm not even sure if the friend was going for the role of Elena. That would be really awkward if she was, but
that would be an awkward drive home.
Yeah.
Okay. I did not know that. Last thing to bring up was the. Actually, you know what? No, I'll bring it up when we talk about the gameplay elements for it. So, let's dive into the game in earnest, right? You know, we've discussed a little bit. I've rattled off a bunch of history facts at mm-hmm. you, but development facts. But in terms of the game itself, I guess the first question I got to ask Bill is, what are your thoughts on the controls? Because that's really where the story is always going to be at least decent in an Uncharted game. We'll yes. get to the story in a moment. But the controls, I really feel, are what makes or break an Uncharted game. So what are your thoughts on it?
So for this game, right off the bat, I will say, like, control-wise, 80% of the time,
it works every time.
they're perfect. Like, they're spot on to the console games. Like, everything feels the way it should. But there is a 20% time where it feels a little off to the point, especially if you. So when this game came out, it was right after off the heels of Uncharted 3. Mm-hmm. And Uncharted 3 controls very well.
Yes.
So Uncharted 2 and 3 use the Havoc physics engine for their physics in a gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Golden Abyss does, because neither did Uncharted 1. That used its own in-house physics engine from Naughty Dog. I have a strong suspicion that this game also uses an in-house physics engine.
I could see that because they were building this engine from the ground up with the system. So mm-hmm. it would kind of make sense.
And there are moments where like you'll be like, okay, that did not feel nearly as smooth as like you remember. And then there's the biggest issue I think I have with the controls is aiming with the guns. Thing about the Vita that's really awesome, it has two analog sticks.
Yes, yes.
They're a little sensitive, though, on this game in particular.
So what I like, the kind of workaround is that if you, for that, I agree with you. However, because you can aim with the gyro as well, what you do is you move the joystick till you're in the general vicinity of the enemy and then you fine tune it with the gyro. So once you master that, it's a really fun mechanic because then you can get really good at aiming quickly. The downside to that, though, is that because you're constantly fidgeting with the Vita and the gyro, I would notice, like, I would start out upright, and after, like, 20 minutes, my Vita is, like, horizontal, and I'm, like, looking, like, on an angle at the screen, trying to make sure I can see everything.
Yep.
That wasn't always fun to do. It never ruined the experience for me, but it was something where I'm, like, oh, shoot, I gotta, like, adjust this.
And then, yeah, it was kind of, like, one of those things where, like, because we were still on kind of the backbone of a gyro on handhelds, like, because the 3DS kind of did it, but the... We still hadn't really figured it out yet. So this was kind of that early stage of like, all right, we're kind of figuring this out. I'll give the Vita credit. It doesn't have the problems with the 3DS screen where it would, if you moved it, it looked wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
And the Vita's OLED screen is one of the most beautiful screens ever made on a handheld.
Period. In fact, it's actually disappointing that when they did the remodels, you know, version 2 and 3, they downgraded to an LCD.
I always laugh because it's like, it's actually a superior handheld in every way, the remodel. Except for the screen, and I think the screen is a deal breaker.
What do they add in the remodels of it? So besides the downgrade of the screen,
they're mostly the same. I think they kind of tweak some of the button placement. Mm. The big key thing, though, is because the OLED screen isn't there, the battery life's actually better.
That makes sense. The OLED is bright. It's such a beautiful,
gorgeous.
I actually thought my OLED was busted because there is like when it's showing black, when it's just a black screen, not that it's off, but it's showing the color black, you will actually see like cracks in the back of the screen sometimes if you have all the lights off in the room. And I remember being like, what the fuck? Why is there cracks in it? It's just because of OLED.
OLEDs are weird, like how they work.
It's very odd. I don't understand it. It's witchcraft, Bill.
Like a little off topic, but like, so they ported a couple like a, Wii and PS2 era games onto Vita as well.
Mm-hmm.
Two in particular that I always talk about are like Muramasa Rebirth and like Odin Sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Those games are gorgeous on the Vita screen.
Mm.
Like hand-drawn 2D, like anime, like artwork and like sprites. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It is mind-blowing how good they look.
So they were PSP games that they ported to the Vita? I'm sorry, or PS2 games?
So one was a PS2 game and the other was a Wii game.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You said that. I was, yeah. When it, for some reason, that first half just went in one ear and out the other. But okay. No the other part of the gameplay, so obviously other than the aiming the guns and, you know, running and shooting, the platforming, they added something kind of cool with this where, you know, normally Uncharted, you aim where you jump, you hit X to jump, and depending on which platform, if you aim to the right, then Drake will jump to the right, you know, the normal platforming shenanigans. In this one, when you're traversing the sides of the walls, you can draw on your touch screen, and it'll like take the path that you draw. So if you see like a series of ledges that you want Drake to climb up, you can just draw across the ledges, and a little highlight thing will happen, and it'll follow along, which is kind of cool because then it's a cool touch, because if you get tired of hitting X and doing that, then you can just draw on the touch screen, which normally I would say, well, that kind of defeats the purpose of platforming then. If you're not having to do anything, you can just draw a line. But the fact that it's optional and it doesn't really take anything away, it's just it's an added feature, not like the necessary mechanic, I think it's kind of cool.
I enjoyed climbing up ropes with the back touchpad.
Yeah,
because if you rub down the back of the thing, it was kind of like you were climbing a rope.
Down, sorry.
the rear touchpad is still one of the most fascinating and peculiar things about the Vita, because it's like, who asked for this? But it's like, it's kind of cool when they actually do something interesting with it.
Tearaway. Tearaway, I will sing that game. I need to do an episode on Tearaway, because that game does not get talked about enough for how inventive it is. I know it was praised in the press and it was praised at the time, but because no one bought a fucking Vita, no one talks about
it. That's why Media Molecule ported it to PS4.
Under the Unfolded or whatever. Yep. And it's a shame because you lose all of the cool features they add. And speaking of touchscreen capabilities and back touching and all that other back screen.
Oh, actually, before you go into that, though, I wanted to bring up one thing. Do you remember the trailer where they were showcasing this game and the motion controls didn't work?
No.
I remember when one of the trailers, like they were I think it was at like an E3 or something, they were showcasing the motion controls, and the rig that they had, because it was projecting on a screen, the rig wasn't recognizing the motion controls. So Nate was just stuck on a rope, like just sitting there, and he wasn't doing anything as they're like rubbing on the screen. And I'm like, oh, Sony.
You poor bastards. I didn't. I'll have to try to find that video then. That's kind of funny.
I'm hoping I'm not just making like this isn't one of those just like Mandela effect memories I'm having, because I swear that happened at one point.
It's possible. I wouldn't be surprised, especially with early like versions of the tech on that type of thing. You know.
Also around that point, there was like this running joke with like every E3, like Sony had some sort of technical hiccup.
Really, around 2012, that was like a theme.
Like from like 2010 up to like 2000, like. Right before PS4 came out, because I always remember for anyone who remembers like the Wonder Book PlayStation Move.
Yeah, I do thing. Actually. That's worth a lot of money now.
They are, but I always remember during the woman was trying to showcase it and it just wasn't working. And so she's there wagging the remote around as like the sparkle magic Harry Potter thing was not doing anything. And I'm like, oh, this is, because I remember that was like the year too where like E3 was, this was the beginning of the decline of E3, where like it was like everyone, the writing was on the wall that this was on its way out.
Because that was around when Nintendo stopped doing, they started doing their directs instead of doing the thing.
Yeah. And that was around the point where like it was like people always had to like, because console wars are still a thing for some reason.
Well, and they still are.
People had to always argue how like which studio did it best. And I always remember like people were like, Microsoft was boring because Microsoft doesn't know how to advertise. That was before Microsoft figured out how to advertise video games.
Yeah.
And then it was like everyone was like Sony was the way people described Sony's event was like they're running up this mountain. They're like about to reach the top, like the first place at the top. And then they just tripped over this book and stared at it for 20 minutes.
And it was the Wonder Book. Yep. I actually remember I used to work at GameStop, and I was that thing was on sale for like $9 used, like complete in box. And I'm like, oh, that seems really cool, but I don't know if I'll ever play it.
Yeah.
Should have bought it. I could have gotten it for $9. Now it's like, what, 100 something?
Yeah. That was like those Fallout like nuke, like collector's editions, like the nuclear bomb like sets. I got mine for like legit $10 at GameStop because they were just throwing them away because they had too many of them.
That's wild.
And they got to be worth something now.
Probably. I mean, a lot of collector's stuff, I would assume, is. With the other part of the back to Golden Abyss, with the other part of the touch controls, That you could also, one of the other aspects of it was that there was, you would do like charcoal etchings. Mm. So this game has a lot of collectibles.
It does.
A lot of fucking collectibles. They're everywhere. And so there's somewhere like you'll find these charcoal etchings, which essentially, you know, a piece of paper will appear on the screen. You rub your finger over the touch screen and then an image appears on it. There's other things where there's other moments where you'll see physical items on the screen and you rotate them with the back touch screen and then you rub off all the dirt on the front touch screen. It's not time, so that would be a tedious thing if you're under time, if you're under a time limit where you're having to like use the back and front mm-hmm. at the same time, but you can do it at your leisure. It's not an issue.
Fun fact, for the longest time, like I didn't realize the back touchscreen moved the item.
So I didn't either, actually, when I first played it.
I was like gyroing it, and I guess when I was gyroing it, I was kind of like touching the screen, and I was kind of like, oh, I guess you gyro it, and then I was like, no, this isn't working. What? And then I finally figured, I was like, oh, you have to move it with the back so you can rub off on the front.
Yep.
Which, I'm not going to lie, is probably my favorite use of the touchscreen in this game. Like
rubbing off the items?
Yeah, but like,
giggity.
It just kind of like, it reminded me a lot of like Resident Evil or like Ace Attorney, where you like examine the items and you can kind of like move them around. And
yeah,
like
yeah, I could see that then.
It was a cool, it was a nice use of like the touchscreen, and it felt very much in series.
Yeah, I think like the touch controls for that, as much as they are quote unquote gimmicky, it works for the Uncharted games because like Uncharted is meant to be a historical, like almost Indiana Jones, you know.
Yeah.
Drake isn't an archaeologist, but for all intents and purposes, he might as well be one. Where the touch controls don't work, in my opinion, are in the hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually like the grenades.
Yeah, those are fun.
So to throw grenades, you would have grenades on the bottom. You tap the grenade icon with your thumb or whatever finger you want to use, and then you drag it. You tap and drag to wherever you want to throw it on screen. It's pretty accurate, too. Like, you can accurately throw it pretty well. I mean, no more so than just randomly hitting circle and just tossing a grenade like you would in Uncharted 1, 2, or 3. But in this, you actually have to use a touchscreen. That does work. But the hand-to-hand combat, like if you go up and you start mashing square, then you might do a couple attacks, but then all of a sudden it'll go into slow motion and you have to either dodge the enemy's attacks or block or do some type of like a parry or something like that. And you swipe in the direction that it tells you to swipe. I hate that. I hate that so much. It takes you out of the, like, you're like, yeah, hit in square. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, I got to do this. Okay, what do I have to do? And then you have to move your hand. You have to completely take your hand off of any comfortable spot of the controller of the buttons on the right or left side and then swipe and then move it back.
Yeah.
You know?
And it was not, it's accurate, but at the same time, it's like not accurate at times. Like,
yeah.
Like it depends on how you swipe it. Cause I had times like, particularly going up from the bottom, it would flash red. And if it flashes red, it gives you like 1 second to try again. And then it fails whatever you're doing. And it's like, it was just like tedious. Also, I hate like excessively putting my fingers on that beautiful screen.
I with you, because I remember you always trying to wipe, like get rid of my like the oil from my fingers, just want it off the screen. But I was actually able to get into when I failed a swipe. It only happened once in my recent playthrough, but I was actually able to fail twice, and I get a third one. I think I failed three times before I completely failed that segment of it.
Yeah, they give you a little leeway.
Yeah, but it's still just not very fun. Like it's not great. The times that the touch works are when it's not timing based, and it also when it doesn't make you move your hand, because to do anything touch in the game, with the exception of the back touchscreen, because your fingers are already pretty much there, you are kind of forced to move your hand away from somewhere that's comfortable on the handheld, which wouldn't be an issue when it's something that's kind of not timing released, not like a twitch reflex type of thing, like the charcoal etchings, like the rubbing off the dirt from different artifacts, like when you have to chop through bamboo with your machete, and then you go up to bamboo, you tap the machete icon, and then you swipe in the directions it tells you to, and then Drake will actually kind of do that thing. It's a cool little immersive type of thing, like because when if you go up to it and it says swipe right, swipe diagonal, down, left, and then swipe right again, Drake will do like a Z shape when he's doing it. So it makes you feel like you're kind of part of this a little bit. With those touch controls for the combat that I mentioned before that didn't quite work, the game designer, Garvin, defended them, like, really, like, adamantly, not just, like, some type of, like, corporate, you know, trying to save face bullshit type of thing, like, trying to toe the corporate line, but, like, he seemed to passionately really think it was a good idea. And I don't, he in the one interview I read, in the making of thing I read, he took issue with people calling it a gimmick. He's like, what's the point of putting a game on the Vita if you're not going to use the Vita's unique control scheme? And I'm like,
he's got a point there.
He's right, but doesn't mean, but there is a thing where it's like Tearaway uses that, but Tearaway is perfect with it. This is, it feels very much shoehorned in. And I think, in all honesty, as much as it's like, as much as I have no issue with the touch controls inherently, I think the game would have been better if they removed touch control fighting.
Yeah, the fighting's the weakest aspect.
Especially because that's the final fucking boss. Yeah, and it's like, that's not, there's no skill involved. It's not even a quick time event. You can literally, if it wants you to swipe right, you can just keep swiping right like multiple times. You don't have to time your swipe. You can just keep doing it.
And you get like five chances to fail too. It's like, it's not like you fail once and like you're seriously in trouble. Like your health meter goes away for this. They have like this, it's almost like an Ace Attorney style like strike system down at the bottom.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I didn't even notice that. It does. Oh, no, you're right. For the bosses, they do have that. I totally forgot. It was fine. It just, it's the same issue I have with Uncharted 1, where Uncharted 1's final boss is just a series of QTEs.
Yeah.
Versus, I legitimately think the only good final boss, like, in all of Uncharted is from Uncharted 2. I think 4 is the second best, but all the others are just bullshit.
The one in Lost Legacy isn't bad. It's just a little tedious.
Yeah, you're right. Lost Legacy is pretty good too. But those are kind of along the same lines as, like, 4, where it's, like, semi-QTE, semi-not, semi-a little bit of, like...
4 was just kind of epic because it was, like, the pirate ship, like, sword fight.
And with... burning pirate ship too. Like I have to replay 4, man. And this one, yeah, it's the final boss is all just swipes with the touch screen.
It's funny too, because it kind of fakes you out too on who the final boss is.
Yeah. It fakes you out a couple times because you don't really like what I will say the villain in this game I find pretty interesting, and we'll get to that in a moment.
One of the villains. The other one is pretty generic.
It's pretty generic, yes. But I think that's important, and we'll get to that. The other thing that John Garvin defended too was that he, like I said, he didn't feel the controls were a gimmick. The touch controls were a gimmick. He brought up a good point, which, as much as I think it would have been benefited removing the hand-to-hand combat with a touchscreen from the game, he brought up a really good point where it's like, well, that's to help immerse you. Like, you're putting your hands on the enemy just like Drake is by you touching the screen. I'm like, oh, I never really thought of it that way. Which I guess if I didn't really think of it that way, then maybe it didn't do its job. And I'm a little bit gullible's not the right term, but like I get suckered into things a little bit more easily when it comes to gimmicks like that than other gamers do. For example, I think I was saying this to Chris from Retro Hangover, and we were talking off mic when we were getting dinner about the N64 controller. I always felt that because when you play first person shooters with the N64, you hold, you know, the center spoke and then the right spoke usually, right? The right hand side. And you usually hit the Z button to fire, which felt like a trigger to me because you're pulling in towards you like you would the trigger of a gun or something like that. So to me, every time when I would play James Bond on it, I was like, oh, this is like I'm shooting a gun because I'm pulling the trigger. So it felt like this immersive part of the experience. Actually, sorry, this is a bit of a tangent. Fun fact, did you know they also considered in GoldenEye that to reload, you would have to take like a controller pack and take it out of the bottom of the N64 controller and put it back in?
That would have been a nightmare.
That's why they didn't do it. They were like, no one's going to want to do that ever. Like, if you're going to have to reload hundreds of times, and you're just
going to... Especially because that port is not the easiest
to get. No, it's not. Not even in the slightest.
I'm just imagining that. Like, that game would have bombed because no one would... After like a minute, be like, nope, done with this.
I feel like there is a line of immersion in every gimmick that if you go too far into it, then it just doesn't become fun. And that I don't know what that line is. It depends on the gameplay, in all honesty. For this one, that I think the fighting didn't work. But sorry, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say, like, I think the biggest problem with it was like it just like inherently like you do it once, you're like, oh, that's cute. And then like after like the 12th time, you're like, all right, I'm over this now.
Exactly. It's not, wasn't my favorite.
Like particularly the cutting down like the branches or the like the forest, like foliage. That was cool the first time, but then you run into it about 20 more times in one map and you're like, okay, this is not as fun as it was anymore.
It's one of those things where it's like, if they did it once, it's like, why did you even bother putting it in? But then I don't know what the right balance of that would have been. You know what I mean? There is a balance to be had, but you have to find it.
I think the smart thing to do would have to, I don't know how they would have done it, but like to do it like, say like the rope climbing or the platforming exploration, make it optional.
I could see that, or you make it so there's really good rewards behind them and you make them less. So like maybe there was like, I think there's like, I forget how many, I think there's like 30 some odd chapters in Golden Abyss. So maybe every like 5 or every 8 or something. So you only use it like 4 or 5 times throughout the whole game. But when you do, and it encourages you to find it, it's like, oh, there's some good shit behind there. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Like maybe there's a really good weapon, or maybe there's like a whole bunch of secret treasures, not just like one, which is what it is normally. There's like one hidden secret in there, but maybe like 6 behind it or something, you know, something like that. But yeah, no, I'm kind of with you. So yeah, that's pretty much the gameplay. You know, you have a generic third person shooter. That's not to say it's bad. It's just, it's a third person shooter, cover based, like the Uncharted games are. You can hone your aim. You can like do fine touches with your aim with the gyro. You use the touchscreen for grenades. You use the touchscreen for hand-to-hand combat, which is fucking dumb. There is some stealth sections, but overall, it's an Uncharted game. It's a really well-made Uncharted game, but with a lot of extra collectibles, like a lot more than Naughty Dog.
A lot of waggle, as they say.
A lot of waggle, yeah. Now, in terms of story and kind of... Actually, hold on. Before, let's save story for the end. We already touched on it in the beginning, but I just want to... The visuals in this game are amazing.
I still think it might be the best-looking Vita game.
I would say Killzone gives it a run for its
Killzone's
money.
Killzone's up there. I mean, Freedom Wars is another great one that looks really good.
I've never played. I've been meaning to get it, though. I've heard about it.
It's one of them, though. Like, you can definitely tell. Like, when I saw... This game literally made me want a Vita because of just how good it looked.
It looks phenomenal. It's amazing.
It looks like it honestly, it's so close to being right up there with Uncharted 1. Like, it's almost amazing how, I mean, if you squint a little bit, you can tell this is clearly on a handheld. Like, it's a little pixely at times, but
also the skyboxes, you can tell, or makes it like, and I'm not even like throwing shade at it, because I actually think the visuals, like, they're very well made, and it's not only graphically pleasing, it's also aesthetically pleasing, because while the skyboxes are a little bit more rough around the edges than their home console counterparts, it still blends well with the surroundings. It's not like the skyboxes stand out. It's just that if I took the time to look at the skyboxes, then I noticed, I was like, oh, it's a little bit blurry, or it's like, oh, it doesn't quite match exactly. Like, you can see where the light's coming from. Not, the light doesn't feel like it's coming from the sun. It feels like it's coming from some other source, you know?
Another thing I noticed too was, so because obviously like the PSP was slightly more powerful than the PS2 in terms of power, like it was very much based off of like,
was the PSP slightly more powerful?
It was more powerful, but it was held back by the media. It was kind of like the N64. It was
really,
it was more powerful, but it was because of the limitations of its like media of choice, it was kind of bottlenecked at times.
Huh.
That's why like you'll look at certain games like, and they have like fur and hair textures, which the PS2 famously couldn't do properly.
I did not know that. I always assumed it was like PS2, but just slightly under PS2, but it's actually PS2, just slightly over.
It's kind of like how the Game Boy Color is technically more powerful than the NES.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, because the Game Boy was meant to be, Game Boy Color is another one of those systems where it's like, it's bottled, it's combined in with Game Boy, but really it should be its own thing.
That's like one of the biggest like debates on the internet, is does it count as its own thing, or does it count as an upgrade?
I think technically no, because Nintendo doesn't count it, but I think also technically, like literally technically, it should, because it is a, I mean, I guess at the same time, there's a new 3DS. Yeah,
that's like the argument people make now. It's like, I consider it its own system, but I understand the reasoning why it wouldn't be as well.
You know what? I think the only reason why I'd consider its own system, because there was a lot of games that came out for it. New 3DS Plus was like, or the new 3DS or whatever the fuck it was called. I can't remember what the stupid naming scheme they chose for the enhanced 3DS was. There was like, what, three games that utilized those features?
Xenoblade.
Chronicles X or whatever it was.
One
of the
Fire Emblem Warriors was another one.
Oh, really?
And I assume Hyrule Warriors as well, maybe?
I didn't think Fire Emblem would have used the, whatever. We're not here to talk about Fire Emblem. So with Golden Abyss, the visuals are phenomenal. Oh,
what I was trying to say with that before I got lost. One thing I noticed right away is, so you know when the load screens for every Uncharted game, they usually have like an iconic key item from the game?
Yes.
Is spinning in the corner?
Yep.
This game, it's an amulet that is a very important part of the story we'll get to later, but it has a lot of like shine textures on it. And when I saw those, I'm like, whoa, I've never seen that on a handheld before.
It's like Ben Studios really did a phenomenal job with the visuals of this game. And it shows that they talk about it in that article I've been quoting a bunch, but they mentioned how like it was a blessing and a curse to start so early. They were ahead of everyone, but they also were the guinea pigs. So it's like it was a win-lose situation where like, yeah, they got the head start on everyone. That's why Uncharted Golden Abyss looks amazing for a launch title of a system alone. And then on top, it still is one of the best looking games, even though it's a launch title. Like it's just, it's phenomenal.
It's still funny too, thinking about it. Like they picked Uncharted at a time when Uncharted was just this new IP that was kind of interesting. And then by the time their game releases, it's become one of the most acclaimed, like iconic franchises with massive expectations. And it's like, they kind of were like, crap, like we picked this just as a thing to kind of release because we liked it, and then it's like now we have all these expectations we got to live up to, which I think they did personally. But
I do too. I think actually we can use that as a segue into the story then, because that the story is what ties all of these different elements together.
Because I've always said with the Uncharted series, like one of the reasons why it's kind of divisive with a lot of people, like I've noticed people that like absolutely can't stand Uncharted, and I think the key is the gameplay is fine, but the gameplay is not the reason you play an Uncharted game.
Yeah.
The reason you play Uncharted is for the story. And if you don't like the story, you're not going to like Uncharted.
And if you don't like poppy type, like pop fiction type of stories, Indiana Jones, if you don't like Indiana Jones, you're not going to like Uncharted.
Yeah.
And Uncharted, I will say its biggest flaw in its design, and you saw it a little bit more pronounced in this game, but for a different reason, is that they pick set pieces first and then design the story around the set pieces. And so sometimes, like Uncharted 3 is the worst example of this, where like they're like, we want to do platforming on a capsized ocean liner. That's a really cool idea. Okay, how do we work that into the story? By having Drake literally get kidnapped by pirates in the middle of the game, and when he escapes, he lands back where he started and says, that's convenient, meaning you didn't need that fucking at all. You could have taken that entire segment out of the game, and it didn't make a difference.
Yep.
In this, it had the opposite issue, where it didn't have enough of the set pieces.
Yeah, this game, one of my main criticisms of Golden Abyss's levels is that after you see like the first three, you've basically seen all of the game.
Yeah.
Which isn't bad because they are very pretty to look at. But when you're coming off of, say, Uncharted 2 or even 3, I mean, 3 is all over the place, but at least it's very pretty all over the place.
Yes.
It's kind of disappointing because you're like, oh, I guess that's all we're seeing. I mean, it looks really nice, so I'm not that upset, but get used to seeing a lot of forest and cave.
Yep. Lots of wet walls.
Got to show those shine effects.
That's pretty much the biggest issue with the game, which is weird to think, because like normally to me it's a criticism of me, or that I levy towards the series, where it's like, well, you focus on all the set pieces and you don't, like, you have to work the story around it. And this, I think the set pieces are, there's just too few and far between. Like Uncharted 2 was like a good, like they wove the set pieces in really well to the narrative. Uncharted 3 was a little more ham-fisted, and then 4 was back to being kind of where it was. And in this, there was just no set pieces.
No, this one was more about the story, honestly, and the world.
And the story in this, like just as a quick synopsis for listeners, and spoiler alert for those who have not played the story of this game, but basically, yeah, obviously you play as Nathan Drake, our legendary hero of the series, and you are going on this adventure with this guy named Dante, who has recruited you to help him find stuff. Basically, he said he found some type of treasure in Mexico, or I think it was it Mexico or like Latin America?
Yeah, something like that. It's also implied that Nathan and Dante have worked together in the past.
Yes, and that Dante is kind of a piece of shit. Yeah, like he's a lovable piece of shit, but he's a piece of shit.
Nathan Drake is also kind of a piece of shit, but like at least Nathan Drake, you understand him from playing the series and you know more about him.
Yeah.
This guy, though, it's like you don't have that 3 games of previous backstory to, like, endear you to the guy. So you're kind of like, this guy kind of sucks, but I kind of like him at the same time.
I forget who the actor who portrays him is, but phenomenal motion capture acting, phenomenal voice acting, the whole thing. It was a motion capture performance. It was great. The writing was really good for him, too, in all honesty.
Yeah, John Garvin's an underrated writer. Like, the Siphon Filter games have a great narrative. I mean, Days Gone got a lot of crap, but I really like the writing in that game.
Didn't he get like a little lambasted on Twitter somewhat recently?
Yeah, he's no longer part of Bend Studio, sadly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he left after the controversy.
I don't even remember what he said. I just remember it was something where, he was complaining about, he was going off about political stuff. Yeah,
that's what it was.
Yeah. And in all honesty, he didn't need to. Like, I'm not even saying that to like, I don't know what the right term is to like to save face or something like that. But like I remember reading his argument. I'm like, your argument makes no fucking sense, dude. Like I understand you're sad that your game didn't sell that as well as you hoped it would, but it's not because of the story.
No, the story was great in Days Gone.
Yeah.
I think the problem with Days Gone was, just before we get back to just a little thoughts on Days Gone, I think the big problem Days Gone had was it was a zombie game that came out when people were tired of zombie games.
Yeah, probably most likely. Yeah. I'm tired of zombie games still. I'm tired of zombie stuff. Like, I don't give two shits about, like, I never bothered watching The Walking Dead because I'm just tired of it already.
Well, I think Days Gone came out shortly right around when the hype for Last of Us Part 2 was being announced. And I mean, spoiler warning, Last of Us Part 2 is also a very decisive game.
Yeah. I love that game. I don't think it deserved the criticism that it did. Anyway,
I have mixed feelings on it, but I'll leave it at that.
We'll talk about it off mic. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. Anyway, so what Dante is trying to ask Drake to help with, which Drake does not know at the beginning, is that Dante is kind of on the track to finding one of the ancient cities of gold. There's seven mythic cities of gold. Mm-hmm. One of them was Quivira, which is what they keep mentioning in the game. However, upon looking something up, I'm a little confused now because this game clearly takes place in like Latin America or like Central America or South America, somewhere not in the U.S. And when you, at least according to Wikipedia, Quivira is in Kansas. Or like Arkansas or some shit, like in the Midwest of the United States. And it was indigenous people who lived there. And yes, the Spanish, the conquistador, I forget the name of the Spanish conquistador that did it. He did visit it, apparently. So I'm a little confused where the information they got from this game was, unless there was something discovered in between when this game released and that whatever this Wikipedia article is. I mean, this game's over 10 years old now, so.
Oh, man, it really is.
Yeah, it's 11 years old this year.
The Vita is 11 years old.
Yes, which doesn't make any sense.
I just died a little inside there.
It got old real fast, right? Anyway, but you're tasked by Dante to help him find the city of gold. And along the way, you find out that he's actually, you know, he's worked with some other people. You meet this girl named Chase, who her grandfather was also trying to chase after this, no pun intended. And he's still alive as far as you know, but he's gone missing. So there's a lot of backstory where Dante worked with Chase, but then kind of double crossed her. You also find out that Dante worked with this guy, general named Garo, and General Garo. And for all intents and purposes, dude's a fucking prick. Like he's your stereotypical, like dictator general who's trying to get a coup, and he needs the money for his ongoing war, and so he's enlisted Dante to help him find this city of gold, so that way he can. It's all this stuff, but what's interesting about the game isn't necessarily all the buildup and all the it's the dialogue and the relationships, mm-hmm. but it's also the character of Dante is fascinating to me. He's this bizarre combination of like. He doesn't want to necessarily hurt Drake or hurt his friends, but at the same time, he will, at the drop of a hat, just fucking, betray them, like, yep. with no hesitation.
His voice work, too, is, like, one of the most endearing parts about him entirely. Like, he's voiced in the game by Jason Spizak.
Okay.
And, or Spazak. I'm not Whatever. Sure about that pronunciation.
But, Whatever his name is.
He does a... excellent job. Like, he chews the scenery, like, the entire time he, like, is doing this role. Like, you can tell he's just, like, going way more extra than he needs to.
Yep.
And it is a joy to listen to, especially going up with, like, Nolan North.
And what's wild about the character, too, is that he, you know, he kind of comes off as a little meekish. Like, he's a little meek. Like, he's the guy that talks big but doesn't have anything to back it up, yeah. really. But you find out, really, he's just, like... it's almost like he's like a sleeping bear sort of where, you know, you don't want to fuck with him, but if you fuck with him, you better watch out because apparently this dude's got a shitload of money and hires an army of mercenaries by the second half of the game who goes against General Garo, who was hired him in the first place. So he literally has enough money to hire his own army. And the only reason he does it is because he's cheap. Yeah. He's rich beyond all belief, but that's not enough. So it kind of actually the more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm discussing with you, it really ties in well with the theme of the game of just greed. Because the whole yeah. thing is the here's a spoiler, listeners. The reason it's called Golden Abyss is because they do find this city, and the reason why that it was sealed off to the world is because the indigenous people didn't know this, but the gold was radioactive,
yep.
and it killed them all. And that's why all their bodies are like bizarrely well preserved because they're all, yeah. And Dante knows this. Dante doesn't care. He wants to sell the gold and put it into the ecosystem. And now it's going to irradiate a bunch of people. And he doesn't give two shits about it.
That is honestly like talking about the reveal of that. Like that is one of my favorite reveals in the entire game where it's like they finally find the golden abyss and all of a sudden like they hear this like, clicking sound. It's a Geiger counter just chilling there. And they're like, what is this doing here? And then they find out, oh, the gold is radioactive. It's like, wait a minute. That's why.
Mm-hmm. And Dante knew all along. That's mm-hmm. why the Geiger counter was there, because Dante had somehow knew or had a suspicion of it or something like that. It's a really good, like, kind of double cross. And Dante's death scene, which you don't actually technically...
implied death
scene. It's implied. You don't see him die.
Yeah, because Drake can't kill him. Like, that's actually a big key moment of this thing where Dante calls Drake out telling him, like, because Drake threatens, says basically, like, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to leave you here. You can escape if you want to, but I'm detonating this entire place when I get out. Mm-hmm. And Dante makes the claim that Drake does not have, like, he doesn't have the courage to do it. Like, he won't do it when he actually gets there. And... spoiler warning, when they get to the point where they're going to set it off, Drake can't do it.
Yeah, Drake. And it's funny, we're at Retro World Expo, and the person who wrote the review that I'm about to cite is here at the Expo Center. Jeremy Parrish said that was one of the weirdest moments for him because Drake murders hundreds of people throughout this game. And when it gets to Dante, the guy who has betrayed him, the guy who has tried to kill Chase, the guy who is willing to sell radioactive gold to unsuspecting people, Drake's like, nope, can't do it now. Even though he had no compulsion before, he could kill at will. Mm-hmm. And that's always been, I love the Uncharted games, but that's always been like a weird... it doesn't bother me because I'm able to differentiate the gameplay portion and the story portion, where this is clearly like heightened for gameplay purposes, but not for like real story purposes type of thing.
It's kind of like this weird thing where like if they're like a not important character in the game or like they don't have a personality, it's like they're irrelevant to Drake's weird moral compass.
I think what's weird about the Uncharted series in general is that there is a lot of murder. but you're still, but the characters are still treated as morally good people. And it's like, you, like, to me, you can, it's, I'm able to, like, you know, suspend my disbelief because it's all self-defense. You know, Drake isn't just like running into like a random building and just shooting up the place. Generally, he's getting shot at first. So it's generally self-defense. But with that said, it's still weird to have someone murder hundreds and be like, I can't do this right now.
Yeah. And I mean, even like, this is like a weird recurring theme for Drake too, throughout the series, where like, even in like Uncharted 3, right at the end where like, the main villain of that game, I forget her name.
Yeah, I can't remember who it is.
The blonde lady.
Yeah.
When she's in the quicksand.
Marlo.
Yep. When she's in the quicksand, like Drake literally, like, there's a split second where he's going to try and save her, but she wants the necklace too badly. So she, sinks into the quicksand and it's too late. But it's like, there was a split second where, despite everything this woman had done to him throughout this game, like, he still had like the moral compass of like, I'm going to save her.
And even though I've murdered hundreds of people just to get to you.
They were just red shirts.
It is a very weird, I don't know, juxtaposition of the two. I don't know. It always kind of weirded me out. But I think I like the character of Dante just because he's more interesting than most of the other villains in the series. You know, like the first game, I think it was Eddie.
Yeah, the first game's got the weakest villain, in my opinion.
Yeah. He's just, it's all greed. The second game, Lazar is the main villain, and he's also kind of a weak villain in terms of character.
Lazar is boring, but like then you get the side villain. How can I forget his name? The British guy.
Who's the British guy? And
you team up with him early on in the game, and then he betrays you.
Oh, yeah. Harry.
Harry's much more interesting in that game.
Yes. And then in the third game, Marlo is somewhat interesting, but only because of her backstory.
Yeah.
I would say the most interesting villain, in all honesty, the most interesting villain in the series, I think, is Dante.
I'd argue maybe Uncharted 4 has Rafe, right?
Yeah, Rafe.
Rafe is pretty interesting, too.
Yeah. Okay, you know what? No, maybe Rafe a little bit more. But, like, Dante is a close second, which is weird because, in all honesty, like, I mean, this isn't, not saying we're going to end the episode yet, but this is something I think it'd be worth talking about because I've covered all the Uncharted games with this. Now, with us talking about this game, I've covered every Uncharted game on my show. What would be the ranking for this? Like, for me, if I were to rank all the Uncharteds, 2 is still my number one, followed by 4, followed by 3, followed by 1, followed by this. And the only reason I don't put this above 1 is because 1 was the template. So I feel like they're so on equal footing that I have to give the edge to the one that didn't have like a template to follow, that had to create its own template.
Oh, where'd you put a Lost Legacy?
Oh yes, Lost Legacy. Fuck. I'd put that in between 2 and 3. Like, actually, you know what? No, sorry. I do 2, Lost Legacy, 4, then 3. I think I like 4's story more than Lost Legacy, but I like Lost Legacy's gameplay a little bit more.
That's fair.
You know, I think that's where it would be. What about you? What's your ranking of Uncharted?
So I'd say for me it goes 4, 2, Lost Legacy, 3, Golden Abyss, the original. Fight for Fortune. I'm just kidding.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, Fight for Fortune is part of this. It was a trading card game.
Yep.
But you could only play with like using the Nier ability on your Vita. Yeah. So like, who the fuck played
Nobody.
It?
But it was a thing for a while there.
Apparently, it was reviewed okay. Like, it was a decent card game.
Into
for
it, and I'm like, I kind of want to play this, but then I looked into actually how to play it. I'm like, yeah, I'm never playing this.
I mean, good luck. Like, who's gonna play it? Like it. Though, if you have your Vita, I got mine right here. We can play some.
Maybe I'll bring it to the convention tomorrow.
That'd be really funny. So Fight for Fortune, listeners, was this additional mini game that you could access from your Golden Abyss game, from your Golden Abyss cartridge. And it was just an online card game, kind of like, you know, think of Hearthstone, but before, I think it was before, it was before Hearthstone came out. Because this game, Hearthstone, I remember, came out while I was at my current job, and this game came out before my current job. So there we go. So that's Interesting. It's fine. It's a cool little thing. You can get additional cards by playing the game. And then by playing through the single player, you can get cards for Fight for Fortune and that kind of thing. It's a fun little trading card
game. I just think it's funny that there's an Uncharted card game on the Vita of all things.
Yeah, right? Now we're just missing that Uncharted.
Everyone was so mad that Uncharted 4 wasn't Uncharted.
You know what? No, Uncharted would not have been a good kart racer. I'm sorry. No. It would have been a gag gift. Like, if anything, if they ever do Uncharted, it would have to be like a browser-based joke game for April Fools. You know what I mean? They couldn't release it as a full thing.
That was just because Naughty Dog's really weird tendency of releasing 3 games and then a kart racer.
In 2 franchises consecutively, and then Uncharted broke that.
Yeah.
But,
granted, though, Naughty Dog was a very different company at this point.
Yes. Yes, very much so. I don't really have much else to say about this. Is there anything that you want to add that we haven't talked about?
So we didn't really bring her up much, but Marissa Chase.
Yes.
She is a fascinating character. So one thing about Golden Abyss I will say that I like is it is a prequel, but it is also completely standalone. Like, it does not affect any plot lines from future games. There's references to things in like the future games, but like, you can skip this game and you won't miss anything plot wise, but you can also play this game at any time and it will not like confuse you in any way.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good idea for a prequel.
I think technically this takes place before Drake ever met Elena.
It did.
That's what I thought.
Cause you'll notice when Sully is in this game and for like 2 chapters and then back at the ending.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll notice with Sully's model, he's actually pretty young here. Like, he's still got kind of like the salt and pepper hair going on
instead of the more gray look that you see in the later series.
And I think his like mustache is still pretty like dark at this point.
I think what's wild to me is like, and I'd be no shade towards Richard McGonagall, he looks so much older than Sully is in the games.
I know.
His voice is so much younger than he looks. And I don't mean that. I know that could come off as like an ageist insult. I don't mean it that way. It's one of those things where it's like you hear his voice and then when you see him in person, you're like, oh, you do not look like the way I expected you to look.
Those 2 chapters, I will say, where Sully appears, favorite part of the game.
Yeah. Well, the bromance, man. Sorry, go ahead.
It's just anything with like Sully and Nate's like character dynamic is, it's the one of the reasons why people love this series so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like when for people, so spoiler for people who haven't played Uncharted 3, but the scene where Sully appears to die, that was heartbreaking because you're like that's my guy. Like,
and at that point in time, it was plausible that that could have happened. Mm. That's the crazy thing. Like when Sully almost like when you think Sully dies in Uncharted 3, it was plausible. Like because at that point in time, I think in Uncharted they were already talking about in game, like, how long do you plan on doing this type of thing? They were doing those types of conversations where it seems like Drake's gonna hang up the old gun, the old pistols or whatever.
What's crazy effective too is this wasn't even the first time they did the Sully death fake out, because they did it in
the very first game. Yeah.
And it was like, you would think that like you wouldn't trust it, but the way they did it in 3 was like, damn, like you actually thought for a minute there.
Well, so in Uncharted 1, you didn't know anything about Sully. You didn't have this emotional connection to him. Mm. Uncharted 3, you had 2.5 games of emotional connection to him. And then all of a sudden they do that. You're like, oh shit, did they really just kill off my boy?
Yeah.
You know, it hits a lot harder. But yeah, sorry. So with Chase, you're right. She is an interesting character because she is trying to help find this lost city because her grandfather was looking for it. But she's trying to keep some things close to the vest because her grandfather was ultimately like, not, he didn't end up getting killed. He ended up dying, but he didn't end up getting killed, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, he died trying to find the city on his own. He wasn't killed by the general or by Dante or by any other bad guy. So she's an interesting character because her motivations actually make sense as opposed to like Dante is just pure greed. But like Dante is a good example of how to write a character, a one note character, but add depth to them. Like all Dante is greed. So how can you take that one simple facet and make it interesting? Make it that he could buy an army, but he doesn't want to because he's greedy. He already has all the money in the world. He's just still greedy.
He's got that Mr. Krabs syndrome where he's like, he can buy whatever he wants, but he's greedy and wants more.
Yep. It's just, he just wants to know he has money, not to actually use it. So yeah. it's an interesting character choice. And then Chase just wants to preserve the history of her people, which I'm still very confused about. Like, she's like a descendant of the people that they are like yeah, the ruins.
They clear about that.
I'm very confused by that in this. I'm going to look it up real quick. So like in the game, Drake is talking to Marissa, who inherited her grandfather Vincent Perez's necklace, the amulet. Thank you. And you find out that they are like they're on the trail of looking at finding markers that were created by the Seta Sedades, which was a Christian sect that worked with Spanish conquistadors. I'm going all over the place. I'm so sorry, listeners. But basically, Friar Marcos de Niza, a member of the sect, had been part of a failed expedition led by Francisco Coronado to find the city of Quivera. Following the clues, one referring to a sword of Stephen, Nathan Marissa follow Perez's trail to a ruined Sete Cidades retreat. They find Perez, who succumbed to an illness. He was sick. Her grandfather. And so, yeah, they're trying to track down the city of Quivera, but like, I'm trying to even find, oh, it's in Panama. So it takes place, the initial thing takes place in Panama. And so I'm like, okay, so if they're trying to find Quivera, they're really fucking far off. Yeah,
they're a little off.
So I'm very confused as to like, where, like, this was this before Coronado actually found the city in real life? Like, what? And then if that's the case, if this isn't like Quivera, which they do end up finding Quivera in the game, but it's definitely not in fucking Kansas, it's still in the middle of the jungle. So I don't understand what's happening, Bill.
This is where suspension of disbelief has to kind of come in, and you have to be like, it's like, oh, the video game, I guess.
It's got to drop in like a fucking freight train because it makes, anyway, I really wish I wouldn't have looked up the Quivera thing. I really wish I would have been blissfully ignorant and not known where Quivera actually was based. It's based in Kansas. It was indigenous people in North America. But anyway, sorry. Is there anything else you want to touch on with the game before we wrap up?
Going back to Chase real quick.
Yes.
One thing about her character that I like and then dislike was, I liked her initial characterization when you first see her, where she's very standoffish to Nate. Like, she's not putting up with any of his normal Nathan Drake shit.
Yeah.
Which I kind of liked because it was like an interesting foil where it's like, oh, there's someone who's actually like not going to put up with his bullshit for once.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's a key moment where like he saves her and like helps her out, gets her amulet back. And then immediately that character dynamic changes. And then she kind of just becomes an Elena, but not as good.
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying, actually.
Because like, there's like, so Uncharted games are kind of funny. There's a running gag where Nate's kind of a perv.
Yeah.
Throughout the series, especially with Chloe.
It's a shame you have to sit on something that pretty.
Well, there's like a point in after that scene where like Nate's all of a sudden, they're like, Nate and Chase are really friendly, other than the fact that she still won't let him call her Marissa, which I did find a funny joke later at the end of the game.
Because then Sully could call her Marissa. He's like, well, he looks like my grandfather. Yeah,
that was a good line. But there's a line that this made me cringe so bad. Like, I'm like, oh, that was so forced. Where like Nate, where she's climbing up a ladder and like Nate goes, those jeans fit you very well.
That one felt so out of place for this game too. Like, at least with Chloe, You saw
Chloe was designed to be like a sexual character like that.
Yeah, and she has a sexual relationship with Drake. It's shown in like the intro scenes. So when Drake makes the comment complimenting her butt, it's funnier because they already have that backstory, because they have that kind of flirtatious chemistry. Him and Chase don't have that.
Yeah, I will say though that they kind of win me there, where they have Chase's reaction be like, "Thanks." Like, just a deadpan, like, I don't know how to react to that.
What an awkward comment to make.
That whole scene was awkward. I'm like, wow, they just threw that one in there.
It really felt out of place. Like,
And they never do it again after. It's like it happens once.
Which makes it even worse then, because at least like with Chloe, that's their whole relationship. So if you find that joke cringy, that's totally that's totally fair to find it cringy, but at least it makes sense for the characters of those games.
I actually don't remember. I don't think he ever makes those comments with Elena.
No, I guess which not.
Which says a lot because she, spoiler warning for people who have played, well, actually even in 3, they're married.
So. Yep. That's a digression. We'll talk about that more offline. I was about to digress anyway. No, you're right. Like Marissa she's an interesting character. I didn't even think about that character transition moment. You're right. She does completely change.
Yeah.
Midway through, and it is kind of a little bit jarring at first. You know.
There was also the fake out kiss at the end of the game where I was kind of like, yeah, that was unnecessary.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It was fun to see Sully cockblock Nate again because that's always a great joke. Actually, one of my favorite lines in the game was that ending scene made me smile so much because I'm like, this was a great ending to this game. There's a line where Sully comes back and Chase refers to him as Mr. Sullivan, where he refers to it. He's like, please call me Sully. Mr. Sullivan is the guy that the IRS is after. And I was like, oh, that is a great line.
Sully is one of the best characters in the game, just period. You can tell how much fun Nolan North and Richard McGonagall had while doing this. I'm kind of bummed, by the way, a little bit of a tangent. Nolan North's going to be at a convention up in northern New York over in Syracuse. And I'm like, it's a little bit too far for me. Like, this is already a big enough trip where, like, you know, my wife's being nice enough to allow me to go without the kid for like 3 days.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to try to tempt my fate a second time. I only really get like one of these a year for so anything else that on Marissa or anything else in the game that you want to touch on?
Not really. I mean, we kind of covered, ironically, this game doesn't have a lot of major characters.
Dante, Guero, Marissa, and Drake and Sully, and that's
I will say it. The final boss was incredibly lame just because it was the touch screen waggle crap
twice, once with Guero and once with Dante.
You do Dante first, and I thought that was the final boss, but then Guero shows up and I had completely forgotten about him by that point.
That makes it like Dante should have been the final boss because he turned himself into the villain by hiring the army, by destroying Guero's army, and it would have made more sense, but no, they don't do that. They keep it as, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. I thought that was a weak final boss.
I will say though, the writing for that final boss did save it a little bit, just because the whole game throughout the game, like Drake makes fun of Guero because he has a little stupid little sword, and he's like, it's a fake little toy. Like, what do you do with that? And then at the end of the game, he shows up with an RPG, and it's like, he's like, ah, you traded in your little toy sword for a real weapon. And then he proceeds to shoot you with an RPG for the boss fight, and you kind of do a little platforming thing. And then I did actually like the way the boss ended, where Drake basically like kind of like goads him to be like, where's your honor, Guero? And then he jumps on this clearly about to collapse bridge and then just falls to his assumed death.
Yep.
And I was like, all right, that was kind of a cool way to end it.
It trying to use Guero's character against him, like his pride, his arrogance and that kind of thing. I could totally see. Yeah. I don't know. The final boss for me, that still didn't save it for me personally. Yeah. Like I do like the writing in it, but it felt so like thrown, like after it was such an afterthought. It felt like such an afterthought. Like you have this big emotional denouement with Dante, and he's chewing the scenery as he's leaving. He's like, I actually watched the live mocap recording of it where, you know, Drake and Chase are walking away and Dante's just going, empty handed, empty handed, just screaming his mind.
That whole, actually, there's another scene in the Dante's, the final Dante confrontation that I really enjoyed too, where they actually find this like dagger that actually proves all of Chase's claims.
Yep.
And then Dante, of course, steals it. And this made me laugh because this is the most pathetic throw ever when he takes the dagger and just throws it off screen. And I'm like, that was the saddest throw I've ever seen. I'm like, they could go get that.
Well, I think it's radioactive, so they didn't want to bring it. That was the issue. But it kind of, I think that reinforces Dante's character though. He's all bark and no bite. Like, yeah, he hired a whole army because he can't do it himself. Like he doesn't have, like, he's got the stones, like in terms of like willing to kill somebody, but at the same time, he's kind of, he's weak willed, You know, like he likes to pretend that he's strong, but he's honestly weak-willed versus someone like Chase or Drake.
Oh, actually, that's a good plot point that we almost forgot. Mm. Chase's whole aversion to killing throughout the game.
Yeah, and she never does.
Until right at the end where you're in the final dungeon where like it's revealed she stole Dante's gun, and Drake literally goes like, you know, there's no going back from here. And she's like, we have only one way. And she's basically like, she finally gets over that block she has the entire game. And then the iconic, I'm actually convinced now this is why they wrote Drake this way, where when Drake refuses to blow up the mine, she immediately takes the thing and sets it off. She's like, we don't have time for this, Drake. And it was kind of like, it's like, okay, she's fine, fully just kind of transitioned into like basically what Drake is at this point.
That is, I never thought of it that way. You're right. That actually kind of reminds me a little bit of some story elements in BioShock, but I don't want to spoil BioShock on a non-BioShock episode. Chase ended up being a lot more interesting than I thought. Thank you. Like, legit, the reason I kept being like, any final thoughts? Because Chase didn't stand out to me, but the more we kind of talked about it, the more she kind of felt more... She had a full character arc.
She did. Honestly, my only problem with Chase was them trying to, like, do a lame love story aspect.
They really didn't need to do that.
Well, the problem is, like, we've already had three games that firmly established Nate and Elena are a thing. And you're kind of like, you're like, this ain't going to go anywhere, so why should I be invested?
That's very true. And if it's a prequel, it'd be different if this, like, was after the fact and, you know, say, like, Nate and Elena are divorced or some shit like that. But it's not. This is a prequel, so of course we know it doesn't go anywhere, so there's no point in... doing this, unless you turn it into like a James Bond style thing where there's a whole bunch of pre Elena games and it's a different girl every game, which would be cheesy and dumb. Yeah. I wouldn't like that.
Well, especially because we already know where Drake's story ends, and it's like, I don't want to. When it comes to Uncharted, I'm under the strong opinion. Unfortunately, I don't think Uncharted's coming back.
But I don't think it should. Not at least with Nathan Drake.
That's my thing. Like, I don't think the series is coming back, period. But if it does, I would be so down for more games following, like, Chloe or something.
Yeah, Chloe is Nathan. Like, she, and it already proved that you can do that game with her. Like, Uncharted Lost Legacy is phenomenal. It's one of the best games in the series.
Chloe, Nadine, bring Sam back. I mean, Sam, we could do more. I mean, Sam's a little tougher because we see he does have history after.
Yeah.
In 4's epilogue, which I don't want to spoil because I actually think that's one of the few things that you should play the game for.
I forget what the epilogue is, but we'll talk about that off mic again. But but all right, we got to wrap this up, Bill. We've been going now for almost after editing out some breaks that we had, but we got to wrap this episode up. So, dude, thank you so much. Like, this it's 8:30 at night. The night before Retro World Expo, we're both going to go get some shut-eye little bit.
Thankfully, I have a 20-minute drive home, so I'm not super in a bad spot. Like, and it wasn't a big deal at all, though. It was cool to finally meet you in person.
Right? This is fun.
Got to hang out in my town, I guess. Well, kind of. I've only been living here for about a year. But
even so, we got to hang out in person. We got to podcast person. And well, obviously I know you're going to do an episode on Retro World Expo in a couple, in a month or so. And I'm going to be on that. So I'm looking forward to that.
You'll get to join me and Alex in our annual convention recap, where we talk about what happened and complain about convention etiquette. And then talk about our spoils of war, which especially in Retro World is a very big part of it, because Retro World is literally a giant flea market.
Yeah. For retro games. It's great. Dude, thank you so much. This is awesome. It was awesome to get to meet you in person.
No worries. This was cool.
And so where can the good people find your line, and what would you like to promote? And for my listeners, shout yourself out. What do you got going on?
So for anyone who knows me, I am from two podcasts now. I've got my ongoing The Gaming Collecting Podcast, which is a gaming and anime-based nostalgia podcast I do with my sister Alex, where we talk about all sorts of games, anime, and other topics from our childhood, also some modern things every now and then. And then I've recently relaunched my second podcast known as The 3DO Experience, where me and my co-host Thrack, we talk about the Panasonic 3DO, the company behind it, and everything in between. Josh was actually on the series' second episode, where we talked about who the 3DO company was, which is a great little opener for that show. And then he was also on for Gaming Collecting. He was on our Stardew Valley episode, where we talked about our history with that game and how my sister can't catch a tuna.
Still can't catch one. Spoiler warning,
she didn't catch one, but she finally got one out of the cart.
Yeah, she finally bought one. She cheated is what she did. Yeah. You hear that, Alex?
she's already like raging about the N64 mention earlier, but yeah.
Oh my God. I the only regret meeting you here now, Bill, is that I didn't bring a can of tuna for when I see Alex tomorrow at the convention.
I gotta get her. So our mother sent her like a stuffed animal tuna. I gotta get her to bring it so we can pose with it. like she caught the tuna.
Oh, we got to do that. We absolutely have to do that. But all right. As for my own shenanigans, of course, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter. I refuse to call it the other place. Instagram.
I like what Chris, our buddy Chris likes to refer to it now as Zitter.
Zitter. Okay. Yeah. Zitter. We'll go with that. Facebook, Zitter, Instagram. I'm also on Blue Sky, at Still Loading Pod on all of them. Hive at Still Loading Pod, Twitch at Still Loading Pod, YouTube at Still Loading Podcast, all that good stuff. At Still Loading Pod on most places on the internet, except for YouTube, which is at Still Loading Podcast. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. Giving a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And if the beliefs or if the stories are to be true, if the legends are true, it pleases the algorithm gods. Bill here was nice enough to give me a review, so thank you for that, Bill. Nice. You can also support the show monetarily, patreon.com/stillloadingpod for $1 a month. You'll get all the episodes a few days earlier at a higher bit rate, as well as patron voting rights and quarterly polls to help me choose future topics for the show. At the $4 level, you get everything that I mentioned previously. At the $1 plus, access to mini bonus episodes every month. And then at the $5 level, you get everything at the previous two, plus access to Still Bonding, which is my James Bond podcast. It's a monthly show where me and a couple friends bond over 007. So you can check all of that out, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But of course, my final shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support and help some kids play some games while they're getting cared for in hospitals, please go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. That will do it for this episode. That's all the time I have for you. Bill, thank you for joining me.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Josh.
And I will see you all next time.
Later.